Ladies and gentlemen, could we please take our seats?
Oh, this is comfy.
My name is Bob Lewis. I'm the chair of the Canadian Journalism Foundation. I'm here to wish you a warm welcome to this, our second forum of the winter season. It's part of a series we run that, in spring and fall. I want to thank BMO Financial Group for their generous support. And I'd also like to welcome the national audience of CPAC, the Cable Public Affairs Channel, which has been covering these kind of things for 20 years now. You'll also can send comments and questions to us on Twitter. The hashtag is CJFForum, CJFForum. Before I introduce our esteemed moderator, I want to say a brief word about the Canadian Journalism Foundation, La Fondation pour le Journalisme Canadien. Our mission is to promote excellence in journalism, and we do that at our annual gala, where we honor distinguished journalists and their work. In addition to these kind of forums, the conversation also takes place online at our two websites, jsource.ca and projetj.ca. With Rotman, we also offer an executive media criteria certificate course. We have big plans for the future. One of the things I'd like to see is some of these forums taking place in other parts of the country. So we welcome you here tonight, but we also welcome your support to help us try to grow and prosper. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce an old colleague and friend, Doug Knight. He's got a very impressive CV, the kind that rightly qualifies him to star on this podium. But tonight he's agreed to serve as a kind of warm-up act for the hometown boy who's come back to tell us how he's shaking up the media business in the United States. Perhaps how he is going to convert these digital dimes into big digital dollars. Doug started his career at the Financial Post when it was owned by McLean Hunter. In 20 years there, he played a key role in transforming the stately old weekly into a daily. He teamed up with John Payton at Sun Media, where they were publishers. Doug at the Financial Post and then of the Sun. John at the Ottawa Sun and the London Free Press. They were part of a group that acquired the chain in the leveraged buyout from McLean Hunter. By the time the company had grown from 40 to 180 papers, they had taken it public, they had become knights in a city's newspaper war, they had fought a hostile takeover bid from Torstar, and then they sold it to Quebecor.
Two out of three ain't bad.
I also know what that sold for, but I'm not going to get into that. In New York, Knight and Payton formed a company advising investment bankers on newspapers. They founded Impromedia, the largest publisher of Spanish language newspapers in the U.S., with outlets in New York, L.A., and Chicago. Currently, as I think most of you know, Doug is CEO of St. Joseph's Media, publisher of Toronto Life, Fashion, Canadian Family, Quill Inquirer, and several city magazines. He's also an active volunteer advocate on behalf of the arts. I should warn you, John, that despite the associations that you've had over the years, Doug has agreed to spare no angle in his questioning tonight. So all bets are off.
I know where he lives.
Okay. We'll also make time for audience questions, and as I said, we're looking at Twitter for comments and questions. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, Doug Knight.
Thank you, Bob. How is it possible McLean Hunter still lives? Well, my friend, former partner, John Payton, is either the flavor of the month or the second coming. And John, the last guy who had that gig was crucified.
Yes.
So it's risky business. Now, I've been doing some reading recently, do a lot of reading, but I read Michael Korda's biography of T.E. Lawrence recently, and Michael likes to say, the child is the father of the man. So let's start with the fact that John was born in Glasgow. John's a Scot. Shh. Now, my mother was a Scot. And I have to say, I laughed out loud when I was reading Korda's biography because he was saying, look, the Welsh can be tricky. Beware of the English. They can be equally charming and duplicitous. But he liked the Scots because they're blunt and direct. Now, does that sound like John? Who apparently, I don't believe everything I read in the LA Times, but apparently he responded to a columnist blaming him for ruining journalism by pushing digital, saying, hey, I read your column. You're ruining journalism. John grew up in London, Ontario, in a part of the town where making lifelong friends with bikers was not considered eccentric. After flying through J-School at Ryerson, John fit into the Toronto Sun newsroom, where leaping across the desk to take a swipe at an ME was also not considered eccentric. And let's just suggest that John's not unfamiliar with either taking punches or throwing them. And as a young copy boy, overnight editor, police reporter, GA, political columnist, city editor, and assistant managing editor, all in his first decade at The Sun, John may also have generously delivered the occasional over-refreshed colleague to the relative safety of home and hearth and an unamused spouse somewhere before dawn. And that takes heart. So Jim Brady, who was the former digital editor at The Washington Post and is now the editor-in-chief of John's Digital First Media, told David Carr of The New York Times, the fact that John was a reporter and understands the newsroom culture means he's a very good person to lead this kind of transformation. And what I thought was David Carr's most flattering line in the now infamous story in The Times, he said, he's a real news guy, not some corporate windbag. So how did John get from the heart of the newsroom to becoming the last great hope? So John first moved to the dark side in Ottawa when we launched the Ottawa Sun. John was a logical candidate to be the paper's first editor-in-chief. And launching a daily is not for the faint of heart. And John did a great job carving that unique Sun niche into Ottawa's granite. And editorially, the paper was making its way. Economically, not so much. So somewhere in there, John took the finance for senior executive courses at Harvard, and his suits noticeably improved. John left the newsroom he loved to become general manager and then publisher of the Ottawa paper, where by pure force of will, he turned the paper around. His next move was to London, his boyhood home, where as publisher, he took on the task of turning the London Free Press around, a big traditional broadsheet in a downward spiral that we had just acquired. John fixed the bottom line, he won awards, and he grew readership for the first time in decades. And things really accelerated from there. When Sun Media was sold to Quebecor, John moved to the even darker side as CEO of our digital operation, Canoe. That was November of 1999. Seems like yesterday. But we're talking total immersion in what we were still then calling new media. Now, I had moved to New York in 2000 to also work in the digital world as a managing director of an investment firm where I was sitting on the boards of a bunch of digital companies going through the collapse of the first dot-com bubble. We both learned a lot, including the fact that if we wanted to buy something, raising money on both sides of the border would not be a problem. So in 2001, John and I formed Knight Peyton Media to work closely with private equity groups to advise on media deals. And we worked on a couple of large projects before we were offered the opportunity to start a company to acquire all of the Spanish language newspapers in America. And in a very bleak newspaper environment, Spanish language newspapers were on fire, in a good way. We created a company called Impermedia, and we acquired dailies in New York and LA, expanded to Chicago and beyond, growing in double digits. When I returned to Canada in 2006, John took over as chair and CEO, where he did such a great job, he was named Publisher of the Year in 2009. Now, Spanish language papers were the only papers growing in 2009. Other newspaper investors began to ask for his help and advice, which led him first to the board and then in 2010 to the CEO's chair at the Journal Register Company, a bankrupt publisher of small market dailies and weeklies, lots of them, 20 dailies, 300 non-daily publications and websites, a modest $692 million in debt. Now that takes heart. And if that isn't enough, just last year, the same investors asked him to take over Media News. He now has some 800 multimedia products, an audience of 57 million, and 10,000 employees to play with. So John is now straddling the worlds of newspapers, digital media, and investment banking. It's a big gig. There's a very loud clock ticking and a cross to bear. But I think that's a story John should tell. John.
Thanks, Douglas.
I can't believe you told the story when I hit the managing editor. In my defense, there was two things, and no offense, he was English. That was the first thing. And the second thing, he was wrong, and he was changing my copy, so I apologize. So, good evening. So I'm old media. This is my 36 years as a newspaper man, and apologies, my 36 years as a multi-platform news executive. And it's a career I started as a copy boy about 12 blocks east of here a long, long time ago, it seems now. And I was hired for taking a picture of a belly dancer who was fooling with a drunk columnist. And I was given that night the job of a guy they had just fired for being a drunk. And I ended my first night on the job taking home dead drunk the editor who hired me. In my career, the only reprimand I have ever received, if you don't count the odd suspension, and who does, it read, "You are no longer allowed to order an Armagnac, digestif, or any other after-dinner drink that is older than you are," signed J. Douglas Creighton. This is commonly referred to now as the golden era of journalism. And now, like many of you, I'm struggling hard to teach this old dog new tricks. I'm struggling to accept that what we now know, and what we knew, rather, is no longer valid. And I'm trying to come to grips with the fact that crappy newspaper executives are a bigger threat to journalism than any changes that's been wrought by the internet. All of us have been subjected to the annual spectacle of a gaggle of print publishers gathering on a panel, and Doug, I believe you've moderated a couple of these, where they all gather to declaim print is not dead, at least yet. And it's an embarrassing display, played out time and time again at conferences where our industry heads look like aging ingenues at Stratford, claiming they really can still play Juliet, and nobody has the heart to tell them different. Or worse still, mediocre journalists wrapping themselves in the flag of long-form journalism to ride the value of social media as a reporting tool, a tool they don't understand or care to understand, and then saying that ignorance, and using that same ignorance, rather, to dismiss the phenomenon of participatory journalism. I have to admit, when I hear these hacks cry out that their work can't be reduced to 140 characters, I always think, if only it could. And I would get back all those lost hours of my life reading Thumbsuckers. And while these false zero-sum arguments play themselves out, Rome burns. And in the United States of America, where I work, the fire is burning faster and fiercer than ever before. Since 2005, the U.S. newspaper industry has lost more than 60%, 6-0, of its advertising revenue. And so many jobs that no one can count them accurately. And while this is not yet the story in Canada, I would say the only difference between here and where I live in New York City is time. It's not like the internet isn't coming to your town. The Journal Register Company, the company I took over 2 years ago, and more recently Media News Group, as Doug referred to it, which we now both run under Digital First Media, a crazy construct that could only happen in a world of post-bankruptcy newspapers. Both of them could be the poster children for what ails the newspaper industry in the U.S. We count our products in the hundreds, our employees in the thousand, 10,000 actually, our audience in the millions, and as Doug said, 57 million. And our revenues are counted in the B's, as in billions. And it's profitable, with better margins than an average Dow Jones listed company. And we have titles predating the American Revolution and can stretch our lineage back to at least one predecessor title co-founded by Benjamin Franklin. Well, just about stretch if you stand on a high stool and reach hard. Another title was around to publish George Washington's obit. Unpaid, I might add. And our core mission is enshrined in this nation's that nation's constitution. But at least it is enshrined in the Constitution. And none of the above will save my company, our companies like it, unless we and our industry are prepared to profoundly change how we do business. And I would start by saying you can't fix that what you won't admit is wrong. So let's start with this wrong. Print's coming back. Now, a show of hands, please, if you think that's true, and I'll give you a heads up, this is a trick question. If you work in newspapers, would you please raise your hand? And if you've heard this and you work in newspapers, have you heard this? Newspapers are dead. Anybody hear that from their spouse? Or their mortgage broker? That guy who calls you from Visa, 45 days past, you know, the day you were going to pay him? In America, from 1985 to 2005, the very peak of print newspaper advertising revenue in the U.S., the average annual growth was 2.7%. Again, the golden era. And for those of you who would go unnamed in this town who are wrapping their daily sheet in heavyweight glossy stock, betting on a return to the golden era, it rhymes with Moab. At that rate of growth, it will be more than a quarter of a century before we're back to 2005 levels. And that's not going to happen. Because advertising is getting ever less share of marketers' dollars. Newer, sexier platforms are targeting customers in such terrifyingly precise ways that we print folks are effectively taking a knife to a gunfight. In 2012, in the US, it's expected there will be more advertising on the web than in newspapers. And by most estimates, most Americans now access their news via the web than print. The customers have spoken, but are we listening? And I would argue, not nearly hard enough. Instead, the debate rages on where the news starts, largely print, rather than how people access it, largely the web, and how it might be blocked. And so for a while, we've been treated, particularly in the United States, to spectacles like the online copy enforcer Righthaven, pursuing stay-at-home bloggers obsessed with their pets who happen to pick up the odd piece of online copy for a post. Righthaven, I would say, died a deserved death. I was happy to play a role in that. And now we have the Associated Press playing around with news right. The word right is used a lot by print people. This time we're told news right is out to nail companies who are not bloggers, it would seem, and to gather data on where copy goes. All right, we'll see how that works out. And in the meantime, I would ask, where are the industry efforts to understand and act upon how news is actually created and consumed? Where are the industry efforts on understanding how professional journalists can come together with the people we used to call the audience and who, armed with laptops and broadband access, are in the same business as us? I meant what I said earlier when I used the word struggle. I am not a net native. I'm a newspaper man. My father was a news photographer's assistant and then a printer, and the first hands that ever held me had ink under their fingernails. It's tough enough struggling with concepts such as open publishing and participatory journalism and to let go the control we used to have on copy because of our control of the means of production without print's knuckle draggers refusing to acknowledge we need to change at all. Because change we must. And if we're going to change, we're going to have to admit that the print model is broken. And if you don't believe me, then read any of the newspaper company Chapter 11 filings in the United States, or Clay Shirky, for that matter. If you haven't read Shirky's essay, Newspapers and Thinking the Unthinkable, and you are in the newspaper business, then, brother, let me tell you, just not paying enough attention. His message is simple. If the old model is broken, what will work in its place? And the answer is nothing. Nothing will work. There is no general model for newspapers to replace the one the internet just broke. And the message is clear. You don't tinker or tweak a broken model. You start again anew, and you start to rebuild. In our case, we're lucky enough to rebuild on the foundations of what we had. And to do this, you're going to have to let go of things that we once held true, like we are the gatekeepers of information, that we are the agenda setters, and that we decide what is news and what is not, and that we keep the outside world outside and only let in the chosen few, people like us. So if we admit the print model is broken, what else might we recognize or must we recognize isn't working anymore? I think it's this. As career journalists, we've entered a new era where what we now know, or what we know, rather, and what we traditionally do has finally found its value in the marketplace, and that value is about zero. Our traditional journalism models and our journalistic efforts are inefficient and up against the crowd, again, armed with mobile devices and internet connections, incomplete. Our response to date as an industry has been an equally inefficient and, in many cases, emotional one. You're going to miss us when we're gone is not much of a business model. The French philosopher, French and philosopher, that's redundant, isn't it? We just take out that adjective. Roland Barthes argues that when culture becomes nature, we're in the presence of myth. In our blustering for self-justification, we've created a myth of our value. Without ever establishing its economic value, we've argued our value as journalists, and journalism itself is self-evident and unassailable. This has been, for me, one of the most gut-wrenching struggles to deal with, because clearly journalism is not without value, but for sure how it's largely practiced in my industry, print today, and particularly, most specifically, he said last night, journalism nearly is valueless. Today, news organizations that do not embrace how news is now created and consumed, digital first and print last, are ignoring not only how their customers desire to get the news, but how they understand it as well. We ignore this at the risk of killing our businesses, but worse, we ignore it when the solution to our future is sitting under our noses, the power of our brands. If we would only let go of the past and embrace the future. The University of London professor Celia Lurie argues in her essay, The Brand as New Media Object, that brands themselves are platforms for content. And Dr. Melissa Aronchek at Carleton University argues in her work, Blowing Up the Brand, that the relationship between consumers and brands become less about the consumption of the product than about social relations, experiences, and lifestyles such consumption enables. In an industry that's been hidebound to the production process, printing, but equally wedded to the belief that the brands stand for something, I think the professor's arguments start to point a way forward for newspaper companies as news companies. I mean, just as the printing press divorced the reader from the writer with the pen and created a whole new world of scalable audiences and techniques of communication, the new digital platforms demand journalists use each platform to its utmost advantage. The first step in this transition has been our digital-first strategy, but clearly it's also a case of digital right, the right uses on the right platforms on the right occasions, and not just the simple repurposing of content from one platform to another in order of priority. Repurposing the newspaper on the web is just a bass-ackward idea. And online stories today that do not link are now considered inferior by consumers. News companies as brands cheapen and destroy themselves if they do not allow the social interaction that society now demands of the new digital toolset. Look, for Canadians, Marsh McLuhan knew this when he said the medium is the message. In the news business, particularly a legacy business like newspapers, if we don't understand this and take advantage of the medium's potential, we will cease to be the messenger. And it is in this role as messenger that we have tied up our ideas of brand values, such as a messenger the community can trust, a messenger known for its accuracy, its integrity, etc. And what does it mean to be the messenger in today's new news ecology, where the people we used to call the audience are now equally participants, competitors, colleagues, arbiters, and sources, and all at the same time? And my company, Digital First Media, we started to try to answer that question by first unlocking our brands and sharing our content into this new ecosystem for all to use, and where we in turn aggregate audiences' content curated under our brands. The audience at the Journal Register Company has responded to this initiative by doubling in about a year. Letting go of control, is a very hard thing to do, and allowing the audience or the outside in is even harder. Often when I talk about bringing the audience into the news conversation, the same aging ingenues respond sharply, reminding me that they have connected with their communities, and what they mean are letters to the editors or streeters, that our readers are part of our process, and of course they mean surveys and citizen members of editorial boards, or we hear and act on their complaints, meaning the ever-ineffectual ombudsman. When I worked at the Toronto Sun, both as a reporter and an editor, we said the same things, usually wrapped up in this tidy little phrase, "We produce a newspaper for the guy who rides the Queen Street streetcar." I bought into that when I worked there, even though I was a guy who actually did ride the Queen Street streetcar to work, and it was obvious that half the riders, men and women of color, non-English speakers struggling to find their way in Canada's largest city, looked nothing like the self-satisfied white guys, me included, who sat around the rim each night deciding what was news. The web ensures that that doesn't happen anymore. At least it doesn't happen for long periods of time for a news company trying to survive. Extending Professor Lurie's argument that brands are platforms, at Digital First Media, we've taken our initiative to unlock our brands and share our content, I would say, one step further. In a little place called Torrington, Connecticut, we have literally extended our brand, The Register Citizen, by using the newsroom itself as a platform. At The Register Citizen, we've established an open-to-the-public newsroom, and all are welcome. They're welcome to work at blogging stations set up right in the newsroom. They're welcome to use the community meeting rooms. And they are welcome to attend the news meetings themselves. And if you can't attend, you can participate online because we live stream them. In Torrington, we've tried to embody the basic values of the web: transparency, inclusiveness, interactivity. Online fact-checking boxes on every story is our direct request for help to correct any mistakes we may have made. I believe that this is an act of transparency that is bonding us closer to the community. To be clear, we have accepted we're no longer the old-fashioned agenda setters or gatekeepers of information for our communities. Clearly, communities know what they want and can organize themselves around issues and activities. I'm sure even in Canada, we've heard of this little thing called Facebook. I'm told it's doing surprisingly well. What we can do, however, under the power of our brands, which are still trusted, is help organizers organize relevant information out of the river of content now available in each community. Vince Cerf, who is the chief evangelist at Google and called by some the father of the internet, oh, never called that by Al Gore, I'm told, is very clear about this. People's trust in journalism has always been about branding. And as the community has become even a physical part of the newsroom in Torrington, we are building a better connection with that community than we have ever had before. In Torrington, that community has responded by driving the newspaper's digital audience to more than 5 times its print audience, and it has taken the Register Citizen from 3 straight years of losses to 2 straight years of profitability. Along with the community media labs at all Journal Register company dailies, all 18 of them are now rolling them out over the next 57 of them at Media News Group, Torrington's open to the public newsroom is becoming a new model of community engagement that works and enhances the organization's brand value. This is a brand value being built by the community itself as the community takes ownership and participates with the local news organization, and it helps us establish what those key values the community wants. The gate is forever open now. There is no longer a gatekeeper on community news. Communities will now value those institutions, like a Twitter, that help the flow of news, and those like us that add context and reflect the values the communities themselves set. Adding value to the new free flow of news requires a new news organization as well. Our journalism, tied to the power of participatory journalism, is, in my opinion, an unbeatable combination as we help communities make sense of that river of information on the web. In New Haven, Connecticut, a paper about 6 times the size of Torrington, we have created what we believe is a local newsroom that adds value. It has 4 key components: breaking news, investigative reporting, audience engagement, and widgets. Widgets meaning those things you hang in other people's site to share your content for free. Audience engagement and widgets are the new no-brainers. Newsrooms must share their content, and they must engage in their audience as demanded through the new digital tools that are powering social media. No social media connection, no news organization. It's that simple. While the crowd can be as fast or even faster on breaking news, adding the context we have through our community connection and professional newsrooms is both vital, I believe, and additive to brand value. And I keep talking about brand value, and I always see the journalists turn off, but with no brand value, no money, no money, no journalism. However, it is the reestablishment of an investigative reporting unit, in New Haven's case, the first one in 20 years, because all investigative units have been cut back over the last two decades in many newsrooms across the United States, particularly in regional newspapers. This can add the greatest value. Finally, and again, we're using the new digital tool set, and we're asking questions that others are not asking, and we're shining that big bright light on those areas of the community that certain members of the community would not like to see a big bright light. And for the first time in two decades, we can actually live up to I.F. Stone's maxim of afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted. That virtuous circle is complete when the news organization's engaged audience picks up those questions and demands answers themselves. From a business perspective, I would say we're getting closer to that holy grail of value alignment with our communities. And trust me when I say all of this is easier to say than do, and it takes a commitment from the entire organization. If you're not fully committed, the community will know in a heartbeat, and then you're dead, because a thing of value has to earn its value constantly. And I believe sharing content will mean more prosperity, not less, in the future. One of the reasons I have been so stern on paywalls and other walled gardens is because I firmly believe that in the future, content will go to the audience and not the other way around. Smart, original content tagged with advertising will gain value by being shared through networks. Shared content, I believe, equals influence. And influence in the new ecosystem for news equals engagement. And engagement adds equals value to those advertisers and others trying to reach that engaged audience. While online news startups here in Toronto like OpenFile understand this intuitively, too many newspaper publishers do not. And they continue to plow on by slashing editorial, research, marketing, and even sales resources, our only core competencies to meet profit expectations. Just as an aside, newspapers, I believe, get the investors they deserve. In the United States, with many newspapers either in, coming out, or threatening to go into bankruptcy, newspaper managers appear to be equally bankrupt of ideas as they seek to please investors by slashing costs and driving short-term gains. Investors being no fools and recognizing newspaper managers have no plans to truly transform their business are simply doing their jobs when they keep management focused on producing short-term gains. Investors don't buy into myth, they buy into math. If you want investors to take a long-term view on our industry or our companies, then you better give them a long-term plan that works. Give them a plan that they'll back. And I would add, it should be a plan built on the editorial floor where the core of our business lies. The rest of transformation is mechanics. If it's not core to your business, and a newspaper's core means content and sales, then reduce it, stop it, sell it, or outsource it. And that's the hardest damn thing to say to people when two-thirds of everybody who works for you does exactly that. And I would say, put the digital people in charge of everything. They can take what we have built, and they can make it better. We have been in charge of digital in newspapers since the mid-90s. We are no frickin' good at this. If we were any good at this, I wouldn't even be standing here. We'd be past this point. It's also so very important to get this right, not just for the industry and the investors, but for our communities. The newspaper is the place where communities are formed, writes New York University professor Aurora Wallace in her books Newspapers and the Making of Modern America. Dr. Wallace continues, newspapers are the engine behind the construction and maintenance of strong communities. When they falter, we must ask what else will suffer as a result. We owe it to the communities who have sustained us not to falter just because we are afraid to change. And finally, I would say to newspaper executives, learn to let go and love the net. And I'm here to tell you that you can teach an old dog new tricks. Metaphorically, I would tell you I still chase cars down the street and I bark at cyclists. But I'm picking my marks better now, and for an old dog, I'm starting to catch a few of them. Thank you. I failed the diplomatic corps exam, Doug.
Did he sound like a Scot? So I think, John, the gig is that we get to talk for a bit. Okay. People get to ruminate, and we have a mic in the room, and in about 20 minutes, we'll invite you to have distilled your pithiest questions and step up to the mic. But John, let's just start with the last bit. My real question is, how much time do you have? But to set the context in that, look, you and I have been through every version of ownership. We've had proprietors, we've had chains, we've had public companies, we've had private equity investors. Now you're in bed with the hedge fund world. So why are hedge funds investing in newspapers? What's their exit strategy, and how much time do you have?
There's not a lot, let's answer it backwards. There's not a lot of time. Hedge fund owners are there because they see value. But they see value in a short period of time. And so there's an enormous amount of pressure on executives in newspaper companies, and this includes the Tribune Company, the Freedom Company, the papers in Philadelphia, my companies, Lee, which just came out of bankruptcy, Gannett, where the largest positions in those companies are owned by hedge funders, because they think they've called the bottom of the market. The advertising community thinks they have not called the bottom of the newspaper market. And so there's this constant stress to improve results. I think we're going to see, Doug, in the next 24 months, an enormous amount of horse trading in newspaper assets in the United States because of this, depending on where those investors are in their fund, because they have to stay true to their own investment philosophy. I think we're about to see another round of horse trading of assets as they sell out either at a gain, a loss, a mix, and you know they play a portfolio for a net gain.
No, it's the perfect lead-in. Look, last year, 71 newspapers were sold, $800 million, which was not a great transaction volume for a lot of newspapers, but the most we've seen in a number of years.
Right.
Warren Buffett was there, Warren Stevens were there, Halifax Media, new people are coming in. Platinum Equity flipped San Diego paper, bought it for 50 in 2009, sold it for 110 in 2011. Kind of raises the question, who's going to buy newspapers? Who's going to buy from these guys?
Yeah, there's two schools of thought on this. First, the thought is that it'll be a next round of investors who feel that they too have bought somewhere coming up the other side of the trough, and they're going to ride it back up with this essentially digital growth and less cost. I mean, one of the factors that they're betting on is that same disintermediator that the net is on revenue is also on cost. The amount of cost you can get out of these businesses is dramatic now compared to what it used to be. I think that and the other school is that can these companies go public as they start to again have 10% increases in profit year over year and are a steady bet because they're becoming ever less reliant on capital X expenditures. I mean, what used to be big numbers are very small numbers. I think we're going to see them. I think there's going to be two sets of investors, vanity players. We're going to see this in Philadelphia over the next 2 weeks, where everything from an ex-governor to an ex-mayor are bidding. Wait a minute, that's the same guy in Philadelphia, are going to bid on some properties. They're already private equity groups are starting to band together again because they see this, that they are going to buy at what they think is the low. I think the going public thing is probably the least likely option.
Well, look, let's just stay in that theme for having. You were quoting the dramatic numbers. I think most of the people in the room are aware of this, but in the U.S., guys, frankly, just have better data than we and more timely data than we do in Canada. But from 2000 till last year, newspaper revenues, advertising revenues are down $26 billion. In that same period of time, newspaper companies' digital revenues are only $3 billion. Right. It's kind of coming up the other side. In terms of disruptive technologies, classified advertising is down 71%. Right? $18 billion gone.
And not coming back.
I mean, in fact, talk about being disintermediated. You know, between Craigslist and Monster.com and the rest, there might be, on its best day, $400 million of replacement for $18 billion have just gone wiped off, gone forever. So while you're doing all of the stuff that you're doing, and you've just talked about it a second ago, I mean, part of the game, a big part of the game, is to take cost out of the system while you're building up the digital revenue stream. So again, it's kind of a two-parter here, you know, where's the bottom, and we'll get to that. But can you take enough cost out of the system with that revenue stream falling off as dramatically as it is?
Well, not unless you can start to replace at some crossover moment digital dimes with lost print dollars. I mean, there's two sides to this. When I talked about the part that people don't want to hear is that two-thirds of all newspaper infrastructure are not in news or sales or marketing research. They're in overhead, a whole bunch of people drive trucks and put things on a page.
those costs have to be decreased over the next 24 months by about 50% from where they were about a year ago, so over a three-year period. There is certainly a Journal Register company, which you've had for 2 years, and Media News Group, which you've only had for 4 months. They're well on the way to do that. They'll meet that target. The issue
50%.
Is, yeah, 50% of the two-thirds have to be gone in a three-year period. And so there's going to be blood on the floor on this as you consolidate printing, outsource delivery, et cetera. And those are the two that always get the most amount of publicity. But it's in everything from accounting to, you know, God knows what. The one-third costs that are the same have to be invested in. I mean, you have to build digital products. They're not free. You know, this in your own business. It's not like you come in one day and decide to have an app or whatever you're deciding to do. You have to build this thing, and you have to build products specifically for them. At the Journal Register Company, we have proved that of the 18 dailies, 9 of them last year, half of them were either up year over year in total advertising revenue or within 1%, or within, excuse me, within 2% of being up over last year, and the meaning 2% down, of course. Now, in an industry that was down 10, 12%, it's a remarkable turnaround. And in a two-year period, all 18 dailies at the Journal Register Company now generate more digital revenue than the costs of their news organizations and about half of the cost of the sales organization. So considering where the companies are going, or with the direction of the industry, there's a moment where you can see a crossover moment if you get the right amount of costs out and you grow digital dramatically as we have. We're now in our ninth straight quarter of a minimal quarter over quarter growth of 50% in digital. And we're up against our own comps now, and we're still doing this. And the wind that we have at our back in this is what I was mentioning, that we now in 2012 actually have more run of web display advertising revenue available to us than run of print. So it's a race. When you talk about hearing clocks, I hear clocks all the time. All of the Journal Register companies have as the fourth quarter of 2013 as their crossover moment. And Media News Group, we're trying to construct 2014. The end of 2014 is that crossover moment. And to your point earlier, we're trying to figure out the size of the ditch on profit between now and there. The reason there's so much activity from hedge funds who call themselves deep value investors is they've done that math and they see that happening, that it can happen.
Okay, it's amusing you keep calling it crossover because we've been talking about crosses a lot tonight.
Yeah.
look, you've got a lot of media attention for your bold stance, and there's been a lot of sort of very high profile, very catchy things. 1,000 flip cameras, the newsroom cafe, the Idea Lab. I mean, you've really captured people's attention. How much of that is real and how much of that is just show for culture change and to change people's minds? How much of that actually does help to generate that shift in audience and dollars flowing?
A lot of it is for show. A lot of it is to preach hope, you know, to an industry that you walk into newspaper, they're not joyous places walking into newspapers. And not that newsrooms are going to lead a song and dance line anytime soon anyway. But part of it is to talk about very dramatically and transparently about we're here, we need to go here, there are things we can do here. And some of the bread and circuses, if you will, are about getting people excited about participating. But all of them, Doug, are connected to things we want to do. So the Idea Lab, which is what the Idea Lab is we have a select group of employees over between the two companies, about 900 people have applied for what is about 40 positions. Is where we give employees who win this competition 25% of their time off, an extra $500 a month just as a stipend, and we give them any tool they want and as much of it as they want, from laptops to iPhones to tablets to whatever. And there are no rules other than this one statement: go figure out how to do our business better. And so while there's clearly a motivational aspect to that, for, you know, I want to be the employee who gets, you know, one day a week off kind of thing and play with the new tools. What they're coming back with, of course, are things we can use. You know, it becomes a skunk works.
Yeah.
And the fact that 900 between the two companies have applied, in round terms, we've got this little army we can call, at least 10% of them want to do this out of the 10,000. You know, it's so there's an indication in doing that. The Benjamin Franklin project, where we ended up printing all of our 18 daily newspapers at the General Register Company using zero proprietary tools. You could only use free web tools. Part of that was an exercise, A, part stunt, and mostly because we did do it. We produced all of our websites, sold all the ads, put all the newspapers on the press, and delivered everything to everybody's home. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of papers here. We did this using just any tool that you and I could figure out to download from the web. I wanted our folks to see what was available. I wanted to get them out of the idea where, for those of you who worked in newspapers, everything's always better in the new building. It's always going to be next year in Jerusalem. You know, when that new system comes through, I'm telling you, boss, I can put out a better magazine, a better anything, just as soon as you get me the new system. And we didn't have any money. So this was a way of making him think, your competitors don't. You know, the proverbial two guys in the garage aren't doing that. So it was a way of trying to make those folks who needed to change their culture to try to embrace the web, to be forced, if you will, into getting their hands dirty on it. The other projects that we've worked in, particularly in participatory journalism, crowdsourcing, this is a difficult thing for newspapers to get their head around. And so, I mean, come on down to Torrington sometime and I'll take you to the news meetings where the public's invited in. It's like sausage making, it's ugly. I like the result. You know, but you know, watching the folks come off the street and argue with editors, it's hard on the staff. It's really hard on the staff. But from research done before that moment to research now, the community largely tells us that they like the paper again. You know, it's a source for them to go because that paper no longer has a press. It no longer has a delivery system. We got it out of its creaky old building and put it into a new loft in a more central location. Its audience quintupled. You know, and it went from a loss to a profit. The biggest part of that is the bonding with the community. So an experiment that works.
Okay. Listen, years ago when Bill Gates and Microsoft was before Congress and there was looking like the company was going to be split up, it was a little ugly, journalists asked Bill Gates what his biggest worry was. And they thought his answer would be the Justice Department. And he said his answer was two guys in a garage. Yeah. And it turned out the two guys in a garage were Google. Over the horizon, completely disruptive, extraordinary work. You have said that digital first is not a strategy for the future, it's a transitional strategy. So what are you thinking at 3 a.m. when you wake up in Moscow or wherever the hell you are? Do you have a sense yet, is it coming together in your head, what those two guys in a garage would probably have invented out of all of this? What does that next look like?
I have two things I worry about all the time. The first is time. You know, the idea that we have a lot of time to solve this just isn't so. I mean, there is no legacy media company, and I don't care what format you're in. I happen to be newspapers. If you're in broadcast, legacy broadcast, you don't have a lot of time to figure this out. One thing that happens when we go on the web, we're all equal, we're all partners, you know, for our content. The other issue that I think about a lot is this concept, if content does, in essence, become free form in the sense that you bag and tag it and brand it and sell advertising around it, and then you let it go out to walk around that ecosphere. What happens when you're doing that and there's a more effective way to deliver the advertising? All the time that you're spending on this, you know, you're working with the crowd, you're convincing your advertisers. I mean, right now, for example, we sell about $20 million a year of advertising that never touches a human hand. It's in a thing we call ad taxi. It was $1 million last year. It's $20 million this year, the run rate it's on. It'll be about $100 million about 2 years from now if that free-form content, gathering the audience, the branded audience that we have, sold in real-time inventories, of, you know, bidding on audience, isn't disrupted by two guys in the garage who say, I got a better way to deliver that advertising. And that keeps me up a lot.
Okay, I get that completely. Now, the kind of transformative ideas that you're implementing, a very large corporation, you've got a lot of moving parts. Yeah. But none of them are It's not a New York Times. It's not a Washington Post. It's not a Toronto Star or Globe and Mail. Is this philosophy or are these ideas translatable to someone who's running that kind of enterprise?
It's a good question. I would argue the Denver Post and the San Jose Mercury News are a Toronto Star, but they're certainly not a Globe from a national perspective. I mean, that they are the same size, if you will. Running regional newspapers, and we have hundreds of them, they don't have that brand capacity that a New York Times has, obviously, to garner certain dollars. But we can and are sort of mining all local opportunities through local focus, which gives us a national opportunity by stringing them together, hence the 57 million on the audience. The newspapers together are the fifth largest brand in America by Comscore, second largest in print, second to Gannett. And for sure, this strategy or a version of it will be transformative for those newspapers. I think the issue with the New York Times is the New York Times can't centralize anything. We can, for example, through what Project Thunderdome, as we call it. I have no idea who names this crap at our place, you know, Project Thunderdome. You know,
Saw that cartoon once.
Yes, you know, it's an editorial thing, and of course, editors right away said, "Isn't that two editors enter and one exits?" You know, so unfortunately, that number that you know might have been right in the past. We're able to take 60 people as we're doing in Lower Manhattan right now, and creating a central desk for all non-local content. So we're partnering with the Guardian right now for the 2012 election. We cover local; they do national. We have this partner. In discussions with you know various other companies. We use the street.com's investment journalism to help our mom and pop kind of places understand how to handle their 401ks, which is the US version of an RRSP. And so we can take 60 people and make those arrangements and have very good editors who understand national politics, national whatever. New York Times can't. They actually, and we can spread that over 800 properties. Yeah. New York Times is going to have to find a way to fund that for one product. And I think that's a difficult thing for them to do. I don't think there's any digital first teaching to give the New York Times. And they have a whole floor of programmers who, you know, who take apart news and information on a real-time basis. I don't know if any of you are, I suspect many of you are, sorry, you know, go on the New York Times site all the time. Even a simple thing as an unemployment story ends up with an interactive map by county in the United States, you know, within a 24-hour period. That takes a couple of journalists, some editors, a programmer, a demographer. And there's a whole bunch of things that happen overnight. That's a big nut to crack. And I think that, you know, they're facing this obligation to create that national news everybody wants to aggregate or do very cheaply. My friend Catherine Weymouth, the publisher of the Washington Post, has this great question. She has a national, maybe indeed a world brand that lives on local advertising in a place called Washington, which is, you know, not the most vibrant town for business that isn't government. And she had 1,000 people in the newsroom. She's reduced that to 650, and she's been pilloried across the entire journalism ecosystem for that. But the question she asks is a good question, and the New York Times is going to have to answer this question as well. When we broke Watergate, she says, in the Pentagon Papers, there were 350 people in this newsroom. 300 less than what I've reduced it to. What are we doing? What have we decided to do with the 650 that we have? I know it's not the 1,000 we used to have, but what did we do when we only had 350? It's a good question, and I think nothing in Digital First can help them answer that.
Yeah. Okay. America's exciting. Let's move to Canada for half a sec. Canadians are pretty good digitally, early adopters, high volume, and all the statistics across virtually all platforms. Newspapers have not had a parallel experience, not in terms of timing, the disruption compared to the US. It has been parallel in terms of the big trends. So just give us your sense, because you're a cross-border cat now. You've spent enough time in New York, and you spend enough time back here. What's your sense about the differences between the Canadian and U.S. experiences? Canadians are pretty good at doing a lot with a little. That's one of our global benefits. But Can we get there, or how vulnerable are we compared to the U.S., do you think?
I think you're more vulnerable, we are more vulnerable than Americans. I don't think there is a newspaper network site in Canada that cracks the top 20 when it comes to news sites. If you took a look at the top 20 in the United States, you would find a smattering of newspaper companies. You know, I'd be one of them. My company would be one of them. That's not true in Canada. I don't know if you know that, but if you take a look at those scores, you'll find just about every but Canadian newspaper company. I sit on the board of one, Post Media. And I think people look at that, you know, in the industry and think, they've stole a march on us, those companies that have come in, and why are they trusted for information here when they clearly don't have the resources to generate that? The second thing I would say about that is that Google made a market in the United States, and AOL did as well, as did Yahoo, early on for digital advertising, and convinced a whole bunch of other advertisers that you could have effective online advertising. We're actually benefiting from this now. You know, it's not just print cratering. Digital is growing, or the overall digital market is growing. And there's a way to deal with advertisers and agencies to talk about the value of your brands to get a piece of that pie. I think it's probably true, I haven't checked in a while, that the largest online beneficiary of advertising in Canada is Google. I'm pretty sure of that without having to check this. Again, I haven't checked it in a while, that they have more revenue than probably almost all newspaper companies, I would guess, in digital revenue. Obviously, most of it's search. So there's been this moment where in Canada where we've seen, from an audience perspective and from a revenue perspective, a sea change, which didn't happen in the United States to the same degree. I think it means that newspaper companies here, have to move much faster. I mean, if I was running a newspaper company here, I would be desperate for change, and I'd be setting things on fire just to see if we can make things happen.
Okay, how much do you want to put yourself at risk? Who's going to, 5 years from now, who's not going to be here? Canada, U.S.?
Well, if I had to bet, in Canada, I would probably bet that my old newspaper, The Sun, will not exist. It seems to have lost its way. And in a world where numbers count and the only way, and you can't meet the great demand of a Google or someone else to match their numbers, you have to have brand. And I think that brand is suffering. And so, without it having a place, in readers' hearts, I don't know how you sell it. What are the compelling points to sell to an advertiser? I look at it all the time. You live here, you probably do too, and I can't discern, you know, what the readership would be. So, from a newspaper perspective, sitting here in Toronto, I would think that those tabloids are probably going to get squeezed between free commuter dailies and quality broadsheets. From an online perspective, I think we're going to see a great growth, particularly here in Toronto, of startups like OpenFile. I think we're going to see an enormous successful growth with those companies because they're doing smart things and they're understanding how news is created and consumed. And I think that the advertising community will swiftly move to supporting that. In the United States, is it a big bet or a little bet? McClatchy will survive. It just won't have the same owners, probably. I mean, I think that's what's going to happen with most of these news companies. And if I had to bet, I thought there'd be a huge failure, I would bet on AOL to fail. The component parts of AOL, as it moves rapidly towards being a content company, is going to find itself in a business that we are already in. Content scales really expensively. And they have a vision, as they started to buy the Huffington Post, which now is the Huffington Post Media Group, and TechCrunch, and a number of other content files that they've bought. It seems to be going nowhere for them. Patch is losing $160 million a year. The business of AOL is, to me, it looks just like newspapers. Half the revenue is in a declining subscription business. The other half is in advertising. The half in advertising makes no money. And the other one, relies upon people saying, oh, God, I forgot again to cancel my Visa on the automatic renewal on AOL. So I would bet that those companies which don't seem to be changing to the new model very quickly, I think it'll be the first big failure from a what's now considered a legacy online company. The company I think has got legs that people are underestimating is Yahoo. I mean, Yahoo, as you know, is going through an enormous amount of turmoil with Jerry Yang stepping down, and they're on their third CEO in 2 years, something like that. And now hedge funds and other investors are agitating at their door. But there's a lot of basic goodness in Yahoo. And it is, if you take a look at their numbers, it's a monster. You know, it's about 40% bigger than all of AOL put together when it comes to news. And so I think that that's one that we're going to see. It's going through some management issues, clearly, but I think it'll come out the other side.
We're going to move to the mic. There's a mic on this side of the table, and I'm really old, so I have to take my glasses off because I have instructions. But the instructions say that you're welcome to ask a question. Please provide your name and affiliation. Keep your question brief, and please ask a question. So you're welcome to join. You're welcome to go up to the mic, and we'll start to set it on fire.
Hey, John. Paul Burton with the Hamilton Spectator. Have you done anything with your property similar to the Detroit Free Press, and if not, when?
We don't have the Detroit Free Press. No, it's the Detroit News that's in the JOA that Media News Group has. And this is an interesting thing about the JOA. Because Journal Register Company owns very successful dailies in and around Detroit, I'm actually not allowed to do anything with the Detroit News.
I meant the canceling of the home delivery.
Oh, from a frequency perspective? Yeah. I mean, daily newspapers over the next 2 years are going to, daily will be what we call them. Daily isn't what they're going to be in many locations.
So do you have any immediate plans for that with your property?
Well, I tell you, but I'd have to kill you, Paul. I haven't told them yet. Look, we already have announced in the Bay Area in San Francisco that when I got there, they were going to collapse 13 titles into three, which I thought was dumb as a bag of hammers. I mean, why would we go unlocal? But one of the ways to make all of that happen and save the money they needed to save was to, on one day a week, cancel home delivery and go single copy only. It's important to start thinking about models like that. What Paul was referencing is that they actually canceled days of the week in Detroit. And there's been a lot of debate about whether that's the right thing to do. I think it's going to end up being what most newspapers do, you know, within about a five-year period, probably with the single exception of the storied titles that Doug mentioned, you know, New York Times, yeah. Wall Street Journal, etc.
Alfred Hamid at University of British Columbia. Hi, John. Really enjoyed your talk. And I think your comments about put the digital people in charge resonated with quite a few of the journalists in the room here. So my question to you is, what advice do you have to them when they go into their newsrooms tomorrow and come across 200 years of print journalism and they have to tell their bosses, you're doing it all wrong, I should be in charge? What advice would you give them in terms of making sure they are in charge?
Be fleet of foot. Look, it's a hard thing to do, but I say this sincerely. When I started in newspapers, you know, it was an explosive business. And I started in a company which, at the Toronto Sun, you know, which started newspapers for the first 15 years of my career. We were starting newspapers in different cities, and we were growing dramatically. Pay was ever up. You know, there wasn't furloughs, there was paid sabbaticals, you know. So it was a much different environment than we have today. If I was 21 again, and I was working in an environment where I know a bit about what I know now, and I couldn't convince my superiors, I'd quit. Because what I want to be is an effective journalist. I wouldn't want to work in a place where their idea of preserving the business was to have ever less of it. And what they have mostly ever less of is journalism. I mean, anybody have a newspaper? John, do you have a newspaper from 1982 hanging around your house someplace in New York? If you do, it's this thick on a Sunday. You know, it's a week's worth of papers now. And so if you don't work in a progressive organization, and I would say that we're just starting to become one at Digital First, is why we can hire, you know, the guy who used to run the Washington Post online. It's why we can bring the former publisher of the Rolling Stone and the Daily Beast and Newsweek to come and run all of our sales efforts nationally, because they see something they think's worth being part of. They want to be part of the experiment. That's what I wanted when I got here. You know, in the mid-70s, I get here, and there's this place on King Street called the Toronto Sun, and I never thought I'd work at a place like the Toronto Sun, but the energy in the place, you know, seduced me. And the drinking.
I should just ask you, on behalf of the people in the room who you just told to quit, are you accepting CVs?
You got a green card, come on down.
John, Scott White from Canadian Press. You talked about preaching hope. What advice can you give all of us who have to manage newsrooms where the feeling is the industry is in a lot of trouble, but how do you preach hope? What actual advice can you give us at the newsroom level? Thank you.
I ask people all the time to think about what we're going to do differently, because I'm not going to pretend that the newsrooms that we had, you know, in the 70s and the 80s are replicable.
Replicable?
You know, we're not going to have them. It's not going to happen. You know, at the, I'm going to reference the old Toronto Sun again, because that's the paper I worked at in Toronto. But at one point, that newsroom was, what, 2 blocks long?
Oh, yeah.
I think it's a grocery store now. You know, news aisle 5 and, you know, potato chips aisle 6. I think it's important to start asking yourself in news organizations what it is, Scott, we can do with the resources that we have. And it leads to trying to figure out what the products should be. The issue we have right now is that newspaper people, and I'm part of the problem, well, I'm a big part of the problem here, I guess, is that we keep telling people you have to do everything. You've got to tweet, you've got to put things online, you've got to enhance it through video and audio components, rinse and repeat, make the story better, and the last part of that process, you know, is print. Or it's print last, but it's really print appropriate in the cycle of that particular breaking story or that story. The issue, of course, is we're like electricians coming with a full tool belt and we're going to use everything in this bag, because we don't understand the platforms yet. And the real, when we get more sophisticated about this, we're going to say, no, just these three tools. These are the right tools for this story. When we get better at that, I think newsrooms will get, legacy newsrooms in particular, will get better at figuring out what they should do with their resources. And it becomes an easier thing for them to say, okay. So, for example, the New Haven Register, that newsroom is 30% the size it was at its peak, 30%. And today, it's got a breaking news unit. It has an investigative unit. It has a unit dealing in audience engagement and widgets, the things that we think are important to do. And we've got rid of a lot, and it's also focused locally in New Haven, Connecticut, the home of Yale. And I would tell you that, well, I don't think these folks are, you know, given high fives every day when they go in. If I'm a journalist and we've created a breaking news unit, we've created an investigative unit, it's a newsroom I want to work in. So we told them, we can't do everything anymore. What can we do?
Hi, my name's Stavros. I was a TV producer. I recently quit to found a startup, Two Guys Minus the Garage. And I'm curious, beyond OpenFile, who do you see here in Canada who's doing well? And the second part is, who is failing in their online media strategy, the media organizations?
In Canada, who's
failing? In Canada.
I'm not conversant enough with the Canadian online space to say who is doing well, other than OpenFile, which is something that I follow, and I follow from afar. You know, I'm not intimately in knowledge of anything they're doing specifically. So I can't talk about that. I've started to identify some folks like Pope Polar, who I think are doing some interesting things with audience, but I can't tell you who's failing. I'm just not, you know, close enough to it anymore. From a legacy media business, look, I'm a director of one company in competition with a whole bunch of others. I would hope that we are becoming much more competitive at Post Media than our competitors. How was that for a non-answer? I like that. I'm going to run for office out of that one.
And my name is Ben Peterson, and I am newly in the garage, like this gentleman here.
I hope it's heated, man.
And I'm just curious. I was actually going to ask exactly the same question, so I'll modify it a little bit. But what are some of the key elements that you see in startups that have been successful in the last couple of years?
The first thing that's obvious to me, I think, is a bit of an example from Facebook, and that is that in any startup that's under about a year old, I almost tune out in those meetings, and we get about 100 requests a month if they start talking about monetization to me in that sort of that first period. I think we have no proven model here yet. You know, what is it you're trying to do? If it's these things are either about how to curate or aggregate or originate content, they are either about audience development of different types, how to mine the two, how to use data appropriately between the two areas of audience, content, and then eventually sales. And I'm most interested, I think, a key success of those startups that I've worked with, like Daily Me with its Newstagram product, which just was successfully sold. In early conversations 2 years ago with Eduardo Hauser, we never talked about monetization. We talked about how to make Newstagram a very good product. And Newstagram has a very simple thing. Before you leave the site, it's, hey, Doug, we know you like baseball. Did you see this? That's all it does. And for newspapers, well, Eduardo would say it does a lot more, but that's what it does. And for newspaper sites, it was part of how we doubled traffic, you know, because we were starting to learn a little bit about our audience. We talked about that, at least our guys did with them, a lot. We're working a lot with C-Click Fix. Ben Berkowitz, I think, is a really bright young man out of New Haven, of all places. And C-Click Fix is like old form journalism, but the crowd does it. Remember when newspapers would actually do that, you know, the corner of state and Maine has a big pothole and there would be some story. Newspapers barely cover that stuff anymore. Basically, C-Click Fix is see it, click, complain about it, and somebody will go fix it. We started working with him and taking the power of that brand. And the new politicians can ignore C-Click Fix, but they can't in New Haven ignore the New Haven Register. And so in working with Ben and his group, I don't think we've ever talked about money in any great discussion other than if there is money, here's how we're going to share it. So I think the focus on monetization early on is a big issue compared to perfecting the product.
Hi, John. My name is Brody Fenlon. I worked with you briefly in London when I was a Cub reporter. I'm now with the Huffington Post, Canada. What is the value of a journalist in this new world? Has it changed? And what do you tell people who are studying journalism? I always wonder, I'm never sure what to tell classes of journalism students, what their future is and what they should be doing. But what is has the value of a journalist changed?
You mean other than that, abandon hope, all ye who enter over the newsrooms? It's a biased opinion, but I think quality journalists are the best citizens in the land. I think that those who bring a passion and a desire to commit quality journalism, you know, are worth their weight in gold. I don't think the role of journalists has changed. I think those who are curious, those who conduct themselves with integrity and clearly want to right wrongs serve a great value. The issue when I talk about traditional journalism coming close to having nearly no value is because it's not germane to how people want to get their news now. And that's my issue with it, the fact that we have these old models that we're used to, and so we want to push you, as a young journalist who has gone to the Huffington Post, is not doing this at all, obviously. We want to push you into a format that's not good for journalism, because we're producing things that people don't want, or at least not in the format that they want, or ever less anyway. So I think the value of journalists themselves, good ones at least, have not diminished at all. And what would I tell people, journalists? I said, for God's sakes, you know, don't think that you have to start your career at some legacy media company. I think the idea that you've got to go to the boonies now and work your way up and hopefully your uncle's got a connection at the Globe, that's dead.
Hi, my name's Bill Doskotch. I'm a journalist here in Toronto. So how does the job of a journalist differ in the early 21st century world of participatory journalism versus one more rooted in early 20th century values of traditional notions of objectivity? Like, can your reporters be a person on Twitter and not just an employee?
Well, yeah. I mean, a couple of things. Participatory journalism is just a tool. You know, it's not a replacement for anything. It's part of what's happening out there. I think quality journalists use it and add some contextual analysis to it, or use it to change the very stories that they're working on, because there's an enormous amount of information out there. From a journalist as person role, is that the question? I mean, a journalist early on who was a person and a journalist versus...
Well, I guess more that, you know, most people have opinions about how the world works. They take a point of view to their approach on a story. Can you say, as a journalist, you know, I think the mayor's subway plan is nuts? And you might have readers out there who say, no, it's not nuts, and here's why.
Right.
Or you might have people who say, attaboy, you're right. Out of all that mix, out of that kind of interaction, based on a point of view, is that something restricted only to columnists, or can a working reporter just doing supposedly straight news use that approach to generate conversation?
It's a minefield. Dr. Jay Rosen at New York University thinks one of the worst things for journalism today is the so-called view from nowhere. I have no point of view. It's a completely balanced approach that I take. And he thinks basically that's horse crap, that people do have points of view. They should out their points of view, and they come to stories with a point of view. And as long as it's transparent, we're able to better understand where the journalist is coming from. I think Jay's a smart guy. He's on our advisory board, but I struggle with this one a lot. I do think there's a role for attempting unbiased journalism. I do think it's true that you need to declare, you know, certain biases from time to time. But I have real trouble thinking that you could, for example, as a journalist, tweet that Mayor Ford's full of crap, and then the next day see a story, say, on subway fare hikes, and not have the mayor wonder if the story, if he felt it was unbalanced or unbiased, or biased rather, that your own personal bias didn't enter into that. One other thing,
go ahead.
On that. Yep. I think you need to experiment with this as well. So I don't know if you know this, but I posted our three rules for social media on my blog for the company, and they were blank. Because I get sick of reading about all these rules from companies about, you know, the journalists will no longer do this, tweets are not, you know, it's like that thing in the mirror, you know, objects may be closer than you think. And I wanted our journalists to not feel restricted as they played with this new medium. And I was asked this in being interviewed today earlier at the CBC, you know, has this caused any trouble? Look, for 2 years, we haven't fired anybody because of it. It turns out people will act decently in the workplace, generally, you know, when given the freedom to do so. And so I think you can be a voter, you can be a participant in your community, and you can do that, say, on your Twitter profile, if that's the form that you're using, or Facebook or whatever, and you can still show up at work and do what you think is the right thing. You have opinions. It'd be nuts to think you didn't.
My name's Andrew Potter. I'm with the Ottawa Citizen, which is a digital-first company. It's a post-media company.
That's the rumor.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's Potemkin. Of all the transitions we've gone through, the one I'm struggling with most is what has happened to the old relationship between editorial and advertising as we've shifted to more digital-first directions. I mean, 4 years ago, we got the dummies for the daily pages. We would see the ads blocked out, but we weren't even allowed to know who was advertising on those pages. Like, the firewall was that firm. 4 years later, two or three times a week, I'm in revenue generation meetings. I'm in digital product development meetings where I'm sitting face-to-face with the ad guys and talking about what kind of content we can do that an advertiser will buy into.
Really?
Which 4 years ago was just absolutely unheard of, and now we're not the only people doing it. I mean, there's virtually every paper in the country is now doing things. They call it fancy names, directed content, but it's everyone knows what it is, right? So if I read my Clay Shirky right, that's not an accident. That is the essence of the online business model. So I guess what I'm asking...
No. That's not the essence of the online business model. Online doesn't tell you to change your values so that you're going to end up shilling for an advertiser. If you're sitting in meetings where you're shilling for advertisers, you know, you should put your hand up. I'm a director of the company. Let's talk. That sucks.
Well, but I'm not saying we're shilling, but these firewalls are breaking down now. I mean, it's happening at the Globe and Mail. It's happening in other places where directed content is becoming an essential part of what's going on. I guess what I'm asking you is that happening? Are you feeling this within your own company? Is there any sense in which those
there's a director down? There's a more direct relationship clearly with advertisers and content in the sense that advertisers can target content they want to be associated
right.
with. That's different from before. I mean, the old rule used to be, you know, if there's a plane crash, for God's sakes, pull the Air Canada ad and all the travel ads kind of stuff. I mean, happens automatically now, and the opposite of that happens, where people do want to be associated with it. But actually sitting down to target content for the ads?
No. What I'm saying is the idea that the advertising would have any kind of relation, like, we just, before we weren't even allowed to know what the ad advertisers
were. Yeah, and you shouldn't care.
Were.
You're right. You shouldn't know, and you shouldn't care.
Right, and you don't see within your own business any kind of pushing towards that and need to push back against that?
Not by me, but what I'll say this, with 10,000 people, you know, I'm pretty sure there's an ad director somewhere beating the crap out of an editor,
right.
you know, to try to get what he or she wants. But it wouldn't be a strategy. I think it's a dumb strategy. I think anything that devalues the product, the editorial product, is in essence dumb. Are we getting the hook here, Doug? Did they tow your car?
This is the Twitter feed. Twitter feed. we have time for one more question from the floor, and because the time is clicking along, we're going to encourage everyone. John's going to be here. Wine will be poured, so the questions will be easier. So there'll be an opportunity to continue to ask questions to John. But let's take one more from the floor, and then I'll ask Bob to come up to wrap it up.
Hi, Rachel Nixon, Director of Digital Media for CBC News. You've talked about digital first as a transition, so I'm curious to hear from you, what is the big opportunity in the North American news landscape? Or if I might put it another way, without revealing any trade secrets, what's the one thing your company's not doing that you want to see it do in the future?
Oh, first off, we reveal everything. It's all on the blog. I'm not Colonel Sanders. There's not two secret ingredients. You make the chicken, it's going to taste like we said it did. I don't think there's anything that we're doing that's particularly innovative. Let's start with that. I don't know of a single newspaper company that's innovative. I think we adapt faster at Digital First Media than our competitors or some of our competitors. But I can't think of anything I sit back and, good God, that's innovative. You know, the idea that we put fact-checking boxes on our stories and people said, my God, that's innovative. I said, really? I mean, another version, it just read, but if you just, we moved it up so that people could say, this is wrong, and it automatically emails to the editor and the publisher and the writer, you know, of the piece. But quite frankly, weren't most of those in the comment section already? Already, there, if you went to the comment section, you saw people saying, this is wrong. I don't know why the hell they had this online. So from an innovative piece point of view, I don't think there's any big reveal from us. The one thing I know that we do for sure differently is we've created a sense of urgency. And I know this doesn't sound like innovation, but I'm telling you it's dramatically different for most places where we are. The Journal Register Company, which was bankrupt, if I had to describe it and other companies that I know of and other companies that I see, the difference would be the employees there can sprint a marathon. They're not trying to last a marathon. They're trying to sprint through it because they know that time is of the essence. And when you're in large organizations, and it's a large organization, but it's not a huge organization, you know, Digital First Media, you can tell there are parts of it that still haven't got that message yet, you know, because the M&G side and the JRC side are still kind of being melded together. That's my, you know, the big reveal for JRC is that in that small company, which is about 3,000 employees, they are all... statistically, they're all working very fast, or we could not have had the results that we did.
Great. Thank you, John. Bob?
Well, I want to start first with the moderator. Doug, you did a great job tonight, and I think your deep understanding of media business really did get us off to a great start, so I thank you for that. And John, I think you know this crowd, and I think the biggest tribute to you is the kind of crowd that you were able to attract tonight. This is one hell of a crowd, and so we thank you from the bottom of our heart, for both of you. And let's give them applause. I also unabashedly want to thank our series sponsor, BMO Financial Group, and to invite you to join us for some refreshments. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Douglas.
Well done, man.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was good.
Man, you're good. Right on that.
You're right on.
Send you back to Arkansas. Oh, yes, ma'am. You don't do right. Don't do